This week I'm joined by Chad A. Haag, who is a theorist who writes on such topics as peak oil, collapse, and technology. He is the author of A Critique of Transcendental Mammology, A Peak Oil Philosophy of Truth, Being and Oil, Volume 1, Peak Oil Philosophy and the Ontology of Limitation, and most recently, The Philosophy of Ted Kaczynski, Why the Unabomber Was Right About Modern Technology. In this episode, we discuss the philosophy of peak oil and his book, Being and Oil. If you wish to support Hermetics Podcast, please find the Patreon, merchandise, and donation links in the description below. Enjoy. Okay, so Chad Haag, thanks very much for coming on to Hermetics.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So just before we jump into the Hermetics question, if you could just tell us a little bit about your past and also how you kind of came across peak oil and collapse-based thinking.
Okay, yeah. Thank you so much, first of all, for the opportunity to speak with you, especially on a topic as rarely discussed, especially within philosophy circles, as peak oil. The way that I got into peak oil was actually involuntarily. It was something which some other students at the university when I was a philosophy major back in 2010 had become aware of, I think actually through the writings of John Michael Greer. And it was something which I think was even more pressing in, say, 2010, because the employment prospects for college graduates in 2011, when I graduated, were very bad, especially philosophy majors. So there was a group of students at my university who were making what appeared to be serious plans for an eco-village to basically drop out of an economy that was going to be unsustainable anyway, and instead start what was at the beginning supposed to be just like a survival community. But of course, over time, the ideological concerns became more and more competition over the ideological concerns took precedence over merely the survival issues. But it was something which at first I really resisted, but the more that I actually thought about it on a rational level, I realized not only that it was empirically true, but also that it presented a monumental philosophical problem, which virtually nobody had actually worked out entirely. You had some figures, for example, who were doing really good work on the empirical data, people like Michael Rupert, you know, showing you all of the reasons why there is no alternative to fossil fuels, why the future of fossil fuels is not going to be like the past. People like Michael Rupert, they were really good at that part. And the philosophical side of it, I think John Michael Greer did more than maybe anybody else with that. But still, I think there was a more explicitly philosophical stance you could take. And we did a little bit of that since we were philosophy majors. But after the project kind of collapsed in 2011, and we all moved on with our lives, it kind of remained in the back of my mind for years. And when I dropped out of academia in 2015, that's when it was no longer possible to repress these thoughts about peak oil from earlier years. And it was maybe last year that I finally was able to try to pull together the philosophy with the peak oil. And the result of that was this series of books, which both I've written and that I continue to write at the moment.
So the book that we'll primarily be speaking about is Being an Oil, which is your second book. The first question here is the Hermetics question. You can place three figures or thinkers, living or dead, within a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Well, that's a very difficult question to limit to only three thinkers. But I think that maybe if I could just talk about three thinkers alive today who I consider to be really significant, they would be Ted Kaczynski, otherwise known as the Unabomber. He's primarily known for this really radical stance against modern technology. And in addition to him, John Michael Greer, who's done, you know, this very amazing work in the field peak oil and also in magic. And the third one, I think, would be Pentti Linkola, the Finnish fisherman and eco-philosopher who is most widely known for this very unconventional stance towards global overpopulation. He's the one who's criticized democratic respect for these politically correct procedures of government as something which has to just sort of just be gotten rid of, because if you're really serious about overpopulation, you have to have this strong centralized effort to actually stop human overpopulation and economic growth and things like that, even in the face of widespread public disapproval. And I think that that would be a really interesting group of people to put into a room.
I've read a lot of Greer, and obviously I've interviewed him twice now, and I haven't actually seen him comment on industrial society and its future by Ted Kaczynski that much. Is there, does Greer comment on Kaczynski's work much at all?
Well, the only maybe instance that I can speak of personally is I notified Greer after I finished the book we'll be discussing today with the idea of writing the philosophy of John Michael Greer. So I've written the philosophy of Ted Kaczynski, and I intend someday to write the philosophy of John Michael Greer. And he was, I think, kind of just surprised at the idea. If I remember his quote correctly, he said, "I figured it would be 50 years after I was dead before anybody would try that." But I mentioned the Ted Kaczynski thing as something else I've written on, and I don't believe he commented on that. So, you know, the one time that I explicitly brought up the name, I don't recall that he gave a response on it. Yeah,
which is surprising, because he's recently he's been commenting on the kind of the media's mutation of right-wing environmental politics. Anything which isn't just kind of Extinction Rebellion-esque, the media is changing it into kind of this eco-fascist thing. So I wonder if there's kind of something there where, you know, you start quoting Kaczynski and you very quickly, people assume things incorrectly. But of course, between those three thinkers, all of which I'm familiar with, there is this undercurrent of anti-technology, anti-progress, and basically anti-assumptions of modernity. So from that, I think perhaps I'm going to ask you what you believe or find peak oil is, you know, in terms of these assumptions that we have about society. So what is peak oil for you?
Okay, as far as assumptions go, which, you know, in many ways, the assumptions about peak oil are something which you can't maybe even categorize as one thing. One of the ideas of the book was that you have these assumptions about progress, about technology, as you were just mentioning, which I think are more difficult to deal with because they're not just one thing. You have, from my analysis anyway, five different layers in which you have those assumptions. And it's the distinction between those layers which makes it difficult to notice that your assumptions about objects are one thing. For example, we have this assumption about progress hardwired even into objectivity. An example of this is a student loan. A student loan is something which would not have made sense in the Middle Ages. You were put to death for practicing usury. The early manuscripts of Christianity routinely list usurers in hell. The non-canonical Apocalypse of Peter lists usurers in hell with a specific punishment for usury. But it's become not only tolerated as a necessary evil to try to advance to something else you want to do, but it's actually become something which, if you don't accept this underlying logic that a student loan embodies, people will say that you're out of touch with reality, because a student loan is an inherently contradictory object. It is an object for which you borrow a finite amount of money and you pay back an infinite amount of money and you never actually get out of debt. And Dmitry Orlov has mentioned in one of his books that if you had a space travel company that went into debt and increased their speed of travel to the speed of light, their debt would still be growing faster than the speed of light. It makes no sense logically. And yet, if you question the logic of a student loan, which is infinite return on finite investment, people will claim that you're just out of touch with reality. You don't know the way the world works. What you're talking about is not real. So we have this bizarre sense in which our assumptions, it's not just that we have this assumption of progress and then we have something like student loan outside it. It's rather that the very logic of progress is hardwired into our assumptions about objectivity. This extends to systems. You have systems like economics trying to achieve infinite growth on a finite planet. It makes no sense. And in fact, economics in the ancient world was built on stability rather than endless growth or unnecessary change. But economics in our era has to embody this logic of infinite progress in the guise of a system. You have the same thing in mythology, the idea of the American dream, which is this ridiculous idea that someday, if everyone goes to college, all 7 billion people on Earth can become suburban couch potatoes with, you know, 3-hour daily commutes to air-conditioned offices. And that's the way that the world should be. And that's just the same logic embodied in mythology. You have the same thing in the deep meme, which is simply a shape. And of course, you have the same thing in what I call the soma, which is the fossil fuels themselves. Because to sort of tie this all together, when you're talking about progress in any of those other fields, be it a system, an object, mythology, you're really talking about the logic of fossil fuels as a specific source. And you will only really understand all of those other meanings if you penetrate to that deepest somatic layer. And that is what I really try to accomplish in that book.
In the specifics there, peak oil, I'm just going to try and not assume that the listener knows what it is. So if you can give an overview, but also your, you know, where you diverge from the scientific theory of peak oil.
Okay, so peak oil is simply the geological fact that was noted many decades ago that you can provide something of a mathematical modeling for the rates of discovery, extraction, etc., which will follow something like a bell curve. Okay, so you can do this for an oil-producing region, for a nation, even for the world. And actually, they worked out the models for the peak and then the decline. After that point, you will never discover more oil than you had. You will never extract more oil than you previously had. This is for strictly geological reasons to do with things like the problem of large, high quality, easily accessible reserves. If there's a particularly large reserve, it's intrinsically going to be rare. They've worked out the actual numerical figures for things like if it's this much larger a deposit, it'll be that much rarer. And of course, we've already found those. Also, the problem with quality. If you take another resource like coal, the quality of the coal has deteriorated because we mined the good reserves first. The type of coal that we're mining now is bad. And in fact, Richard Heinberg has claimed that the amount of coal after a certain point is going to yield less energy than it will take to extract it. So these are all scientific facts. And the problem of peak oil is that there's no way to get out of it because alternative energy sources, so-called, many of them actually rely on fossil fuels. So solar panels, for example, are not a solution because the total cost in energy, never mind money, to produce one is about the same with international distribution chains and energy-intensive, highly technological processes. It's about the same as the it'll yield about the same amount of energy as you put into it with fossil fuels. So it's not really an energy source. It's rather a way of storing fossil fuel energy, as John Michael Greer has mentioned multiple times. So we have this problem in which the United States hit peak oil in 1972. You may have noticed, by the way, if you live in the United States, that sitcoms like Dick Van Dyke Show. A young man, as John McGregor is fond of saying, lives with zero debt, pays every bill on time, he buys a house, and he supports an entire family on one income. That was the 1960s. You don't see shows like that anymore. And that's because we hit peak oil as a nation in 1972. We hit peak oil as a globe in 2005. And anybody who's been seriously paying attention to what's gone on since 2005 will have noticed a lot of very serious problems ever since. So we have this undeniable scientific fact, and most peak oil literature is largely going to deal with that. You have your Michael Ruperts, Richard Heinberg's, James Howard Kunstler. They're very good at showing you these numbers. The way that I maybe differ is by showing that many times you can have the numbers and maybe still not notice the way that certain assumptions are creeping into places you wouldn't expect. So many people think of peak oil merely as a type of an engineering challenge, right? And without thinking of it as a problem regarding how we perceive objects or how we think of systems or how we think of mythology or even how there's a basic logic at the level of geometrical shape, as I would call the deep meme. That, I think, has only maybe ever been incompletely dealt with rather than explicitly within a type of philosophical system, especially when I would argue that raises this to an ontological question, which is, how is it that you have to almost go back to Heidegger and say that being itself is something other than what you think? Being, for me, is limitation, and that follows directly from an honest analysis of the way that this works for our era and how you can extrapolate that to other eras. You can do the same thing for the agrarian context. You can do it for nomadic contexts. You can do it for hunter-gatherers, etc.
So in that way that you see being as limitation, do you think that modernity is this sort of veil over the fact that we have these limitations, such as peak oil? You know, do you think that this entire industrial system is just a way of ignoring the fact that our being is connected to limitation?
Well, the grand irony about living in an era of infinite progress, and that's the shape people see the entire world through, regardless of which layer they're in, is that that is the ultimate example of limitation, because the thing which sustains that and makes it appear to be true is precisely the limitation of fossil fuels. And this is something which you might compare to Frank Herbert's Dune, the novel about an extreme desert climate on Arrakis, in which if you think that water is an object like any other, you're going to die of thirst. You have to understand water not as one object, which is simply to be treated like any other. Rather, you have to understand that water is the limit to life on that earth. There's all of these cryptic, sort of mystical sayings in the Orange Catholic Bible, which is sort of something of a collection of wisdom for Paul to learn, which deal with limitation. And I think that the grand irony of living in an era in which even serious thinkers like David Icke claim that limitation is the ultimate illusion. David Icke's metaphysics is that if you're talking about limitation, you're a priori talking about something which isn't real. It's just the Babylonian Brotherhood manipulating your mind to believe that you're limited when you're really infinite consciousness. The irony is even our serious thinkers like David Icke have misunderstood that arrangement, because for us, limitation is such an unclear word. I talk in the book about how it's not at all clear, even for thinkers who have tried to talk about limitation, what it actually means. And the irony that being itself is this thing which we understand so poorly as limitation is something which I think made the writing of this book so necessary.
And The actual philosophy itself of the book is transcendental, because in relation to peak oil, you have this term transcendental oil, which plays a very key part in the actual philosophical aspects of peak oil. So I was wondering if you could just extrapolate on that.
Sure. So the irony about the situation is that if you think of oil as a barrel of petroleum, let's say you even work in the oil industry and you physically deal with this sort of object, you're talking about empirical oil, and more specifically, you're talking about a countersense object. It's as contradictory as a student loan. It's a finite number of gallons of oil. There's not that many in one barrel, but it's the symbol of infinite energy. So it's a countersense object. So the irony of the situation is that you're not going to understand oil better by going to a barrel of empirical oil and just examining it as an object. You have to transcend that very standard of meaning to instead think of oil as you say, transcendental oil, which is not an object so much as it is a type of a set of conditions of consciousness, which are the presupposition of that object. So what I mean by this is transcendental oil is this set of conditions of consciousness for which mythology has to be infinite progress on a social level, for which system has to be infinite return on finite investment, be it in the form of modern high finance, economics, artificial intelligence, whatever. They're all doing the same thing. And if you understand oil to be something of a transcendental, I would say shape, but that might mislead one because that's just the memological layer. It's rather a set of conditions. So it's kind of like Kant, but I would argue that unlike someone like Kant, who's looking for these eternal unhistorical structures, and even beyond somebody like Oswald Spengler, who's going to the historical cultural frameworks, I would take it a step further and say that the ecological context is more primordial than either. And what this book really is something like a redefinition, if I may say so, of what we of our assumptions of ecology. I would argue in the book I'm writing right now that ecology really is just this understanding of these different somatic contexts, the hunter-gatherer context, in which the soma is like woolly mammoth herds, the nomadic context in which it's like herds of camels, yaks, flocks of sheep, the agrarian context, it's large fields of grain, all of those, that's the real point, maybe even more so than just fossil fuels. It's that itself is just one example of many different sort of ecological contexts.
Yeah, this was the something I wanted to comment on, actually. You mentioned that, you know, mammoth hunters in the Ice Age, they would see mammoths in the way that that's the material source of their society, or an agricultural peasant would see grain. And yet we don't look at a car driving plastic items or carrier bags or any of the mass of things which are made by oil. We don't see oil, we see something which is complete and without this previous history. What do you think has caused this shift where our, I would say, progress has changed our perception entirely?
I think that one thing which has brought about this change, in which we do have this sort of detachment from the basis of our survival. So Ted Kaczynski talks about how if you're a hunter-gatherer, you don't have that option. If you're a hunter-gatherer, you don't have the option of sitting out from the conditions which you need for survival. It's just not something that you can do. You have to actually be out there trying to acquire enough food, water, safety from dangers in wild nature in order to survive. And that's not a source of suffering which has to be overcome. Actually, that's, for Kaczynski, the way to remain sane, because if you lose the ability to go through the power process for serious projects like hunting, gathering, or locating water, staying safe, if you lose that opportunity by having technology basically take care of it for you, you will still have this need for power. You'll just, invest it into these silly activities like cheering for a football team, despite the fact that even if your favorite football team wins, your quality of life is not going to be improved in the least. And yet that's where you invest this energy, because you have to put it somewhere. And in a certain sense, I agree with Kaczynski that one of the reasons for this distanciation is modern technology. And modern technology actually fits very poorly into this entire schema. I've noticed, if we're on the topic at the beginning of the conversation, of how, you know, there is something of maybe a mismatch between Greer and Kaczynski, in the sense that, you know, the people I know who are really well-versed in Kaczynski, they find the Greer arguments a little bit difficult to click with their mind, because they think the Kaczynski way of thinking, emphasizing modern technology, is something which is kind of difficult to fit with the peak oil narrative. And I think that the difference is, whereas the peak oil thing, as I was just mentioning with the five layers, that's ecology. I would argue modern technology is the end of ecology. Modern technology is taking away the variability for us to engage with the world in terms of even having it make sense on this level. And I would argue that much of even what I say in this book might be a little bit outdated now, in the sense, well, what I mean by that is the expectation that you explicitly have to see progress embedded in an object. That was something certainly true in the 19th century. But today, the entire process has been reduced to pixelations on a smartphone screen, so you don't even have to carry the burden of explicitly seeing objects embody this logic. It's been taken care of for you. And in the later parts of the book, I mentioned that this is, in a certain sense, the beginning of the destruction of subjectivity, in that, as I mentioned in the later parts of that book, if you allow this process of reducing human experience to pixelations on smartphone screens, eventually you're going to just lose the subject, and you're going to lose the ecological context, and you're going to lose any meaningful distinction among the five layers in the first place.
What would you say to those who think that this loss of the subject, this kind of atomization and complete fragmentation of what many would consider the natural human subject, what would you say to those who see this simply as the next step, as some form of transhumanism?
Well, the irony about the Ray Kurzweil fantasy of being uploaded into a supercomputer and living forever, the irony about that is nothing would guarantee the end of humans more than that. Because if you were to be uploaded into a machine, everything that had made you human in the first place would either have to change, it would have to update to keep up with the specifically non-human parts of that venue, or they would just get rid of you because you would be useless. This is one of Kaczynski's arguments. So somebody could only claim that Ray Kurzweil's migration into machines is eternal life if they don't know what life is. They could only argue that it's eternal subjectivity if they don't know what subjectivity is. And my argument in this book is that subjectivity itself is limitation, and it's precisely the loss of its position as something of an imminent limit within the manifestation itself. That's exactly why we're already starting to lose subjectivity, as technology has taken over that operation of manifestation entirely.
And this loss of subjectivity, it makes me think of something that you bring up, which in the book, which I was actually taught from a young age, which I don't believe they really teach anymore. And I remember being in school, and they used to make it clear to you that when you turn on a tap, or when there's food in the store, you should always kind of consciously be mindful of that and remember that that's not this given thing that's always there, that if water's coming out of the tap, that is, you know, there's a process behind it and you should be thankful for it. One of the things that you make clear in the book is that actually water coming out of a tap now, at least for those in the West, is a priori. You know, that's not, it's almost something which doesn't even have an existence except from the fact it's coming out of the tap to that person in that moment. Outside of that, there's no real existence for the process or the mechanics behind it. What do you think socially has led to this this way of thinking where everything is simply given?
Well, I think that the distanciation from having to actually do anything has largely led to this attitude where with smartphone screens, it's even worse because there you're not dealing with any real entity at all. So with water coming out of a tap, you're actually dealing with something physical. When you're dealing with social media likes, for example, it's amazing that social media likes have become like the most addictive drug. The whistleblowers and social media companies have noted that they studied how to have your body release something like 6 chemicals when you get a like. And it's like the most addictive drug on the earth, and there's no object there. So as modern technology has removed the very ability to deal with objects, in the sense that we basically have lost the objects themselves. The standard of success is the disappearance of the object. We used to have these physical texts which would ship in the mail. Now we have ebooks that pixelate on a screen. The very earliest model of Netflix, for example, was DVDs sent in the mail, and then success was overcoming the object. Now there is no DVD. And the tendency to create a world with no objects, I think, leads people to approach even the objects they actually see as though they were basically just pixelations as well. It would make sense that, you know, if you can, like Facebook has something like 12 billion users, which is rather impressive on a globe with 7 billion people. But we've lost this expectation that there could be limits on things like the number of accounts you could register on a site, the number of likes you could get, the number of hits you can get. And we transfer that over to things like water supply. Even if you live in like Las Vegas or Phoenix or one of these desert cities, you don't have this sense that the water, even in a desert, could be limited.
So behind all this is this ideology of progress. And of course, people will offer up alternative ideologies the same way that they offer up alternative sources of fuel, such as solar panels. I mean, you comment on probably what is going to be the clearest one which people offer as the alternative, which is Marxism. And you state that this is simply another ideology with a false understanding that their machines will outperform those that came before it. So you've tied together ideology and machines and resources here in a way which doesn't make ideology immune to resource complications. So if I can perhaps say that, is there a hierarchy here where kind of resources are almost above notions of ideology and in some senses ontology?
Right, so the idea that Marxism is limited to a specific layer of the hierarchy of meanings, which is not the most fundamental, is a shortcoming of Marxism, which is not often talked about. And the idea that, so in Aristotle, for example, he says that the project of clarification is the project of showing how something that you say in natural language, you're really situating it within one of the categories. So Aristotle was saying, so we're talking about being. Well, what kind of being are we talking about? Are we talking about substance, quantity, quality? We use this word for these different layers of meaning, basically. So I kind of do the same thing myself. I say, okay, so we're talking about Marxism as this idea that the potential for industrial production in capitalism is not the problem. The problem is this this political mode, basically, in which you have the capitalist make profit and the worker is paid less than he or she is worth. And it's that which is problematic. You just need to evolve to a better way of overseeing this situation with even greater productive capacity, I should say, on an industrial level. And if anybody doubts my claim that Marxism uses modern technology. They should just look at the modern state of China, which is, you know, doing more industrial pollution, I think, than just about any other nation. They could look at the Soviet Union, where you had once the fourth largest lake in the world in Kazakhstan, which was turned to an open desert because they were replacing outdated agrarian ways of farming with up-to-date fossil fuel-based modern technological methods of farming. So it's just absolutely absurd to argue that Marxism can be detached from fossil fuels. And the hierarchical problem here, as you mentioned, is that you haven't exhaustively understood the problem. If you remain stuck at the layer of how can we just get better machines, you're at the countersense object layer. If you penetrate below that, you'll find that the very presupposition is this deep meme of progress, this shape of an ascending arrow. And if you ascend even beyond that, you'll get just to the resource itself, which is fossil fuels, which, by the way, is not going to be a viable source of energy for much of the world in the fairly near future.
And you actually say, you know, that the self-enclosed loop of burning fossil fuels is simply to do more activities that burns fossil fuels, which makes me think of exit and escape and alternatives. But of course, we've mentioned many of these, which are spoken about a lot, such as alternative energy sources and alternative ideologies, and those don't work. So in what way can we kind of exit this fossil fuel burning loop?
Well, you're never going to get out of the fossil fuel burning loop if you remain within this type of somatic context in which fossil fuels are the soma. Soma is the ancient Greek word for a body that really exists. I did this to avoid the Marxist jargon, because if I had written this book with references to material, physical, real, concrete, it would have been impossible not to read it as something like a Marxist text. So this was a conscious decision. But soma in the New Testament, if you look at the Koine Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, you see these references in, say, the Gospel of Luke to soma, which are missing from the other Gospels. So I mentioned in the book that if you read the Gospel of Mark, when Jesus is baptized in the River Jordan, it says the spirit of the dove came down and he heard the voice, whatever. But in the Gospel of Luke, it says that the spirit took on a somatic form. It took on a bodily form. And the Gospel of Luke also mentions near the end, after he's resurrected, he eats fish, and he says, you know, he proves to the disciples, look, I got a real body because I'm eating fish, right? So like it was a conscious challenge to the docetic gospels that were circulating in the ancient world, like the Gospel of Peter, for example, which does not present Jesus as a real somatic body. It basically presents him as a phantom, because docetic comes from the Greek word for phantom. It was basically the idea of, well, look, he was a spirit, and that's why in the crucifixion scene of Gospel of Peter, he says he didn't have pain because he was a spirit. So I talk about the soma as a way to say, no, it's a real body, but also it really has to exist. If it doesn't exist, that's missing the entire point. So fossil fuels fit into this, because the expectations, which just seem like common sense to people about progress, they are really references to a somatic body, which it exists right now. But, in the far future, where maybe it exists, but it's inaccessible to be used, the infrastructure to put it to good use will have deteriorated, et cetera. At that point, the ideologies won't make sense, precisely because the somatic body won't be there. This is why presence is kind of the most fundamental category of meaning in my system. So the only way to get out of this is to get out of the somatic context altogether. And you'll notice that any attempt to move beyond peak oil that does not challenge the somatic context. And what I mean by that is, if you're not explicitly going to a different somatic context, such as becoming a hunter-gatherer, which you might laugh at that, but Ted Kaczynski did exactly that, or becoming an agrarian farmer. And you might laugh, but people, around the world, not only, you know, are doing that by choice, but many people are still basically, there are some places where people still sort of do that on the traditional level. So it's something which only sounds impossible if you are so trapped within this somatic context that you literally can't imagine getting out. And I would argue you're only going to get out if you actually go to one of these other somatic contexts. And that's going to happen involuntarily for most people in the near future.
In terms of contemporary movements which are in relation to this, as they're in the news, and I don't know how much you've seen and read about them, but what do you make of Extinction Rebellion? Is this another in a long line of herd-like movements who are just abstaining from responsibility, or is there something more here?
Could you say a little bit more about this? I don't think I'm familiar with this movement.
Well, Extinction Rebellion are an environmental protest-type group who are currently blocking up London, doing yoga on yoga mats and all camping out in tents on a bridge in London and just generally causing a nuisance and stopping everyone. There's a few hundred thousand members, I believe, and they seem to be fairly active. And their primary directive is to make the government aware of climate change. So, you know, in abstract, it's a fairly radical environmental group but my thing with them is that they're stating that it's big business and corporations and the government's responsibility, and to a certain degree their fault, that there is this climate change thing at all, and it could be reversed or stopped if it wasn't just for big business. What do you make of these kind of claims?
Well, I think the first thing I would ask is, do any of them have a backup plan for what they're going to do without the same fossil fuels which they criticize? And I mean, I'm perfectly in favor of criticizing fossil fuels, but if you really scratch the surface, a lot of people, like if you turn on Young Turks, for example, so-called environmentalist far-left American news agency, mm-hmm. if you really scratch the surface, when they criticize oil companies, they're actually just saying invest government money into solar panels. What they're really talking about in their criticism of fossil fuels is just more money for alternative energy companies. And I've shown in the book that you're really actually talking about fossil fuels. So, I mean, there are exceptions. If you have Linkola, for example, who actually would fish in a traditional, he would actually use like a traditional cart to get the fish out to customers. He lived in like a house with no running water, whatever. Ted Kaczynski lived in that hut with no running water. There are people who are actually doing this. But if your backup plan to fossil fuels is to keep living in your condo or McMansion or whatever, and just run all of the appliances on some other mystery energy source, then quite frankly, that cannot be taken seriously.
What do you make of kind of those who blame big business and blame the other for the environmental ongoings?
I would say that there's quite a bit which people could do if they were really serious about it, but they choose not to. So putting all the blame on Walmart, for example, in the United States is understandable because they distribute, from my own experience, very poor quality food. My own experience of shopping there for years when I lived in America, very poor quality food. And you could blame Walmart for having environmentally unfriendly policies and a very bad economic arrangement. But if you still get all of your groceries at Walmart, then you are missing the point that it's your dollars which are funding this operation. And it might sound impossible to not do that if you don't realize that it wasn't that long ago that most people did some sort of food production at home. Mm-hmm. And the village I live in India. It's the same thing. Like today for lunch, for example, I largely ate vegetables from my own yard in the village. They're actually much better than anything you're going to get at a grocery store in America, even one of these, you know, sort of expensive, like pseudo-organic type of places, which claim to be green. You're still going to get better vegetables at home for free. And it's just going to be a better arrangement. And this is something which people could do, but they choose not to. And if people say it's the corporations like Walmart, not to single them out, of course, that's just like a readily understandable example from the United States. And yet they still get all of their groceries there. I think that it's above all, it's a demand that the corporations just give them better products. A lot of times they don't want to actually get out of this cycle of getting in their car, going down there, swiping a credit card to get these unsatisfactory products. They don't actually want to get out of that. They just want to be able to get in their car and get better products. And, you know, once again, I live in a village in India where just about everybody in that village does some sort of food production, whether it be chickens in the yard or goats in the yard or cattle or something. So I just don't buy, quite frankly, the idea that we couldn't move beyond these corporations. It's just that. And I acknowledge, like in the United States, like city of Denver, if you keep chickens in the backyard, the police will come and confiscate them. But I think that we're going to the corporations are going to lose their power in the long run anyway, because they're getting it from fossil fuels and they're getting it from all of us. And that's unsustainable. And people will be forced, whether they want to or not, to go back to a type of arrangement that was actually perfectly normal, like in the Great Depression. If you talk to people who lived through the Great Depression in the United States, many of them don't even want to eat radishes anymore, because in the Great Depression, you ate a lot of radishes because they're pretty easy to grow. Mm-hmm. And that's how people got a lot of food in those days.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, like you said, that's not far away. I mean, I distinctly remember, I believe it was one of my grandparents did occasionally go shooting for rabbits for food, and both of and all of my grandparents had either an allotment or a vegetable patch or something along those lines, which wasn't used in any kind of artisan optional way. It was simply a way of kind of a historically handed down skill of saving money and learning a skill, and it's very quick, you know, the space of kind of two or three generations where all of these skills have been lost quite forcibly as well. In terms of this future that's coming, what do you think the first kind of steps for peak oil and collapse as a process are going to be that we're going to start kind of feeling a bit more directly?
Well, I think that the first steps have already been at work in the United States for a long time anyway, because you know, I left the United States last year at a time when I was working at a truck stop, and I was dealing with the local homeless population on a daily basis, and it was the most pleasant experience I had in America before I left. By the way, was dealing with the homeless. It was a very positive thing. I could easily have an hour long conversation with somebody who would come. And he would beg for water, for example, out of the hose so we could shower out back. He would fill up these plastic jugs and shower out back in the bushes. And you have these thousands and thousands of homeless in the United States. We just pretend that they don't exist. And yet it's more and more people, because there's essentially no job in the United States that could have been replaced by a machine or shipped overseas. And the only jobs that haven't had that happen yet, it's because they haven't figured out a way, and they're working on it very hard right now. So we've already got this dystopia in the United States in which millions of people have already been disenfranchised. They're just not allowed representation. In the media, we instead have this BS that the struggling middle class, you know, six-figure salary homeowners with kids attending out-of-state college, their oppression under the 1% is the only economic oppression the media cares about, because you know, the other people are invisible. And we already have this massive problem in the United States with it. It's just that the media won't recognize it. And quite frankly, the radical leftist campus politics has no space for it, because if it's not explicitly about one of their bizarre made up identity categories, they're just not interested in talking about it. And by the way, the only thing they want to do is post on social media about it. So the problem of homelessness due to outsourcing and automation, it doesn't fit into these, sort of made up categories like 68 genders and all of this BS. So it's not talked about. So the channels where you would have economic oppression supposedly taken care of, they're not interested in acknowledging this type of economic oppression, or they actually benefit from it, because the same, professional social justice academics, like, they literally make their living in the academy writing these weird, articles about how now there's more than 68 genders. They make their living supposedly out of giving voice to people's oppression. They won't actually, they benefit, I should say, from this arrangement in itself, and that's why they're not interested in it. Nonetheless, it's going on. It's directly related to peak oil. It's a direct outcome of fossil fuels distorting our way of life, and it's going to keep going on, because the homeless rates in America are only going to keep going up. I have a feeling that if I had not left that country, I probably would have eventually suffered the same fate as somebody, notoriously deep in student loan debt, and other sort of ridiculous constraints that have become normalized, which are actually making people's lives unlivable. And it's a situation which is only going to get worse, ironically enough, within those first world contexts. I understand that in London, there's also a crisis. One of my old friends who lived in London was sharing, she shared on Facebook that there was a space underneath a stair at somebody's place that was being rented out. And that's the sort of housing you'd be lucky to get in London, is a space underneath the stairs. And we've got a crisis, but they won't talk about it in the media, and it's only going to get worse. And the thing which nobody wants to hear is that that's exactly what the near future is going to hold, only more of.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I've asked James Kunstler and John Michael Gray and Dmitry Orlov, who are all, as I understand it, a fair bit older than you and have more life experience, not that I mean anything by that, but I'll ask you the same question, because perhaps the answer will differ. But as someone who is extremely kind of steeped in collapse literature, what advice do you have for people heading into the next 20 to 30 years?
Well, I can speak on what has worked for me. So what has worked for me was just getting out of America and going to a so-called third world village. And the irony about the situation was that my life got better precisely through doing things which, I don't know, maybe in the first world would be considered to be outdated, right? So my life got better when I got well water straight out of the backyard, and that's what I drink, that's what I shower with. I usually shower just like a traditional bucket shower, which is like what slum dwellers do in India, which is you don't maybe use a shower head, you just use a bucket, and you have a whole shower with the bucket. You use a fraction of the total water. It's actually pretty much a better experience. The water's not heated, it's just room temperature, but that's okay, you get used to it. I get eggs from the chickens in the backyard, which are good enough. You could pretty much have a meal. You could have a whole meal with some rice porridge and some eggs from the backyard, and it's nutritious enough to do that. If you got eggs at the grocery store in America, you would feel hungry right away, because the chickens are living in abysmal conditions. There's virtually no nutritional value left in the food, and it's extremely expensive, both in terms of money for you to buy it and in terms of energy to ship it all over. So the irony about the United States, from what I remember, is it's so much more expensive for such an inferior quality of life, and there's no way to get out of it except to just leave. So I know that not everybody can just move to India as I have, but I would argue that things will only get better in America if people start doing some of these things, well water from your own land, showering in maybe more traditional ways that don't use hot water, chickens in your backyard, vegetables from your backyard, walking as you can. Actually, all of these things, which obviously we could do, we just feel we can't because they're seen as things from the past. But the irony is you can live much better on a tiny fraction of the money before wasted for such an unsatisfying life anyway.
Unless there's anything else you'd like to add, or is there any recent publications coming up or anything, events relating to your work coming up, or anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I'm working on a fourth book right now, which is Hermeneutics of Ecological Limitation, which is the post-environmentalist philosophy that I think needs to be done right now. So I think that a lot of people are concerned about ecological problems, but they don't want to call themselves environmentalists, because you talk about environmentalists and you have this image in your head of elitist hypocrisy and things like that. And of course, it's tied with leftist politics. I try to show in this book that actually the best ecological thinkers right now have nothing to do with either maybe a traditional environmentalist label or with leftist politics or anything like that. And I'm trying to maybe tie this together in a book-length project talking about how ecological philosophy has to move beyond environmentalism. So I talk in this book about Linkola and even some very controversial figures like Varg Vikernes, and of course Kaczynski, Greer, even David Icke. So it's been a pretty fun book to write. I'm looking forward to getting it out there, and more importantly, I'm looking forward to trying to get the debate going on how can we do ecology without the environmentalist label.
I look forward to the release. Okay, so Chad Hark, thanks very much for coming on.
Oh yeah, thank you so much. I very much appreciate the opportunity to have had this very interesting discussion with you.